Say his name, if you dare. Say it 5 times in a mirror. See what happens.
I'm Jamie Roberts.
I'm Robert Landrum.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the films that have you running away, but coming back for more.
Rob, we're coming back for more, and we're doing a special episode on a Sunday night.
Is that special?
Well, we don't really record on a Sunday night, except we're doing it tonight, kind of to get back on track. We have been a little bit tardy, a little bit late. We have definitely been dragging our feet. We've been busy at work, so we are kind of making up for lost time.
Just I feel like I've been busy with family. Like, God, well, these kids take up so much of my life.
Oh, my God. Tell me about it, right? I don't want to get into a whole kind of complaining about I started a family and now I'm complaining about it, but I'm complaining about it. No, honestly, it's been like it's been busy. It took us like 5 weeks to get by the time this comes out, Exorcist would have came out. That's our 40th episode. And it was like over a month to get that thing out. New school year. You were busy with hockey. It's been really, really busy. I don't know if it's coming out of the pandemic. I don't know if it's just starting another school year hockey season. Has it felt busy? I don't know.
Oh, for me it is, because work always picks up in September, October, because we are kind of, our work schedule is revolving around the major sports schedule. Then you got kids going back to school. Yep. Kids in like a whole new situation, in my case, where we're going to a new school and it's French English. And also, like, man, do grade ones always get this much homework, James? You're a teacher. Like, why am I getting pounded with homework in grade one? Is that normal?
That's not, man. I don't know. Like, you're in PQ now. It's like different. Just to reference the pandemic again. Oh, there's the proverbial beer can open. I'm teaching grade 4 and grade 5. Anybody that's been listening to the pod over the last little while knows that I've been a grade 8 teacher forever, and I've moved down the ladder a little bit. I don't give a lot of homework, you know what I mean? My idea is like big overarching projects. If, you know, we spend time in class, we sequence them, we structure them, we scaffold them. But if your grade 1 is getting like inundated with, you know, hitting the books every night, you know what I mean? I might be asking some questions of the teacher.
Oh my gosh. I don't want to say any names, but like, my teacher does not have a good reputation. How are you doing, man? What else is going on?
I'm good, man. Like, switch school, switch jobs, switch into a new grade, new situation. Definitely, definitely different. I got some, I got actually a speaking engagement coming up in the beginning of November. Oh, yeah. I'm going to be down in Toronto. We're going to be taking a look at Candyman, the Candyman sequel tonight.
Yes, you're right. You're okay to call it that.
Well, actually, you know, I mean, that was subject to controversy that I'll talk about later. But we're gonna be doing the Candyman sequel tonight, and we thought about, you know, should we do, you know, a compare and contrast? And
now, hold on, like, before you say Candyman sequel, because the actual Candyman did have sequels. This is Candyman 2022.
No, this is a Candyman sequel.
No, I know it is a sequel, but don't say the sequel, because that implies there was Candyman.
Oh, okay.
Candyman
okay,
2 did happen back in the 90s.
Yeah, so this is, okay, so anyway, so this is, we're doing the Candyman sequel tonight. This was written by Jordan Peele, and this is directed by Nina DaCosta.
Even though it's not like directly a sequel in the sense that like it's happening directly afterwards or anything like that, like there's definitely all this time in between, it would be a nice refresher. But that does beg the question, does this new film fall under that new title people are throwing around? Is this a requel?
I thought about this. So I put out a Twitter question, or, you know, I posted this and I just said, you know, thoughts on the Candyman remake. And I would probably say, like, there was a ton of comments that were in, and actually it was pretty polarizing in terms of how people felt about this movie. Mm-hmm. People either loved it or they hated it. But when pressed, often weren't able to kind of provide any, sort of backup, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of how they were feeling that. And I always think about, you know what I mean? They're evaluating it. So I always think about, you know, that old saying, you know, you got to evaluate the evaluator. And it made me think, well, if you're not, I have to evaluate who is evaluating and you know, talking about this on Twitter, and nobody could really give any reasons why. But Twitter maybe is not the right.
God, you're medium. Such a teacher.
Well, I just, you know what I mean? It's not maybe necessarily the medium for it. I don't know. Is it a requel? Like, one guy actually chimed in and said, you know, I hear what you're saying when you called it a remake. He said, it's not a remake. It might actually be like a soft reboot. mm-hmm. somewhere in between a requel, a reboot, and a sequel. To me, you know what I mean? Like I said,
well, isn't that what the requel is? Like this is in the same history. Like it maintains the storyline, but it's trying to kick off the franchise again. It feels like very much a setup for potentially another one. I don't know. Like it's own movie to itself, but.
Well,
it does feel like it could keep going, and this would be the new jump off point for the next film, right? Like you wouldn't have to go back to 92 so much if you made the next Candyman, if you stayed in this world.
Whatever it is, it's different. It's trying to, I don't know if it's trying to be something. He's pretty intentional about what he's after with this film. I think one of the things we talked about is the execution there. And you know, what do we want from a Candyman film? What do we want from a horror film? And is he able to provide that for us? But one of the things that I think we should always just start off with, Rob, is the one-line challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Who's going first now? I think it might be you, actually,
this
time.
I think it's me this time.
Yeah, it's you.
Let's do it. All right, count me in.
3, 2, 1.
Candyman. An urban legend. Is brought back into the forefront of the local denizens when a local artist, no, when an artist who, with a connection to, with an unknown connection to that community, digs up the legend and repositions it in a new world where the predominantly Black and African American citizens have been pushed out in it, and now Candyman terrorizes a white gentrified neighborhood. Fuck, okay, Candyman.
I think you've fallen victim to my, you know, beat poetry. I think we were trying to grasp words out of a tree there.
The hard part for me is still the grammar. I'm always still trying to stick it to one line, but like halfway through, I realize I need a period and I need to start going. So I have to add like an and or a because as, and it's just like feels like this extendedly super long run on the sentence, and then I just start falling apart. All right, James.
I'm gonna hold on. I just have to burp. Hold on. Okay. Go.
1, 2, 3.
Candyman. A struggling artist looking for a new muse looks inward to his soul and his own community to unleash the horrors of his past and the community's past. To unleash the horrors of his past and the killer that stalks the community that undergoes a werewolf a werewolf transformation. Except this time, it's a Candyman.
Wow. Okay. I feel like we gotta refresh, like, tell these people. By the way, the reason we do the one-line challenge is that me and Jamie hate to go through a plot. Like, a lot of podcasts will take you through a film almost scene by scene, right?
Scene by scene, yeah.
We don't really do that. We do more of the book club thing where we jump around, we talk about characters, we talk about themes. So what we thought was we'll do this one-line challenge to summarize kind of what the movie's, you know, what happens, and then we can kind of move on. We don't have to worry about the plot. But the joke of the one-line challenge is that we fucking suck at trying to recap the movie in one sentence, and we don't write it. You have to do it off the top of the dome, so... That's kind of the fun of this this fucking mess that we make at the very top of our pod. Tell me, do you think it was scary?
Here's the thing. I think the original movie had a lot of scary moments in it. I found that movie to be dark and gothic and brooding in a way. This film, I didn't find scary at all. And then I thought to myself, why am I not finding this film scary? Candyman is a scary figure and the whole idea behind him is terrifying. But why isn't it scary? I don't feel like this guy is really into making, at least in this sense, was making a horror film, but really into illuminating sort of the horrors in life. What about you, Rob?
I found some scenes like unsettling, but not necessarily scary. I'm going to drill down on one particular scene, but there's definitely, well, maybe two. The scene that like I really liked the build up and I really liked the tension was the first scene where the kid goes, and this is back in the 70s, I think it's taking place. He goes to the other apartment building because that's the only place where he can do laundry. He's got to go down to the basement. And I liked this setup. Like he's already uncomfortable because he's got to walk across the neighborhood. Then he's got to cross by some cops who give him a look. Then he's got to go downstairs in this kind of crappy building. And then he goes to this empty room and it has like the crappy, you know, overhead fluorescent lighting. He looks back and he sees a hole in the wall. And the hole in the wall, like to you and me, because we know we're watching a horror movie, we're like, oh, that's going to mean something. Like something bad is in there, right? Kid goes through, does his laundry, comes back out. And as he's coming out, he understands or we see enough movement or hear something that we understand somebody's in that wall. And he's telling the story at the same time about the character who was hiding in the wall.
We've been hiding in the walls.
Cops, because he had a hook hand and he was known for handing out candy to the local kids. They called him the Candyman. Candyman now has become like an urban legend, and so the cops are looking for someone who calls himself that, and basically they're looking to not just arrest but probably shoot down this person immediately because there are so many crimes now pinned to this particular person. Anyway, point is, in that film, in that scene, the kid is like paused, he looks, he sees the hole in the wall, the guy comes out, and it's creepy. And I had like that feeling, like my adrenaline's starting to kick in, like I feel like I'm about to get terrified, but it just kind of didn't get there. But one of the things I thought was weird was that when they cut back and forth, you see the kid's point of view looking at the wall and the man coming out of the wall. Then they cut back to the man's point of view coming at the kid. And the camera's not moving. It's flat both ways. It's still. And it's not even pushing in. And you lose that idea of somebody moving from one side of the wall to the other. Instead, it just like happens. And part of me thought, okay, maybe there's a reason for that. The point is that Candyman, this particular version of Candyman, this guy, was actually not to be scared, like not to be feared. He was actually just a totally normal guy. He's a bit of a...
just living in a hole.
Well, no, he was hiding. But he's described earlier in the film as like a bit of a character of the neighborhood. But other than that, he's not to be feared. So I thought, okay, well, maybe that's what they're getting at there. That like, he's not the Candyman, so he shouldn't be feared. So we shouldn't use all the camera techniques that would normally, you know, instill that fear.
Well, you don't get any jump scares.
Yeah, not really.
There are no jump scares in this film. In the original Candyman, when you say the name, like, I think going back, there was a couple times where like he pops up right behind you. Like you get that.
Yeah, the lights flicker and he's there.
The lights flicker and then boom, he's there. The closest thing you get is when Anthony is in the elevator and mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. actually, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of an homage, who's that artist that did the...
Oh, they were like in Toronto.
Yeah, like the million dots and like all the mirrors and stuff.
I forget.
It's a Japanese guy, I think.
Yeah.
Anyways, it made me think of that one or that artist. And then you've got that. And then he kind of like, you know, he's looking at him at the reflection of himself, right? As clearly the transformation. We'll get into that afterwards. So then that leads to a question that's not even on the docket here. Was this movie too predictable?
Mm. In terms of like,
we can interrogate that later, but just in the sense of,
I think you're right though. In terms of like just the plot beats, yeah. It wasn't that hard to see things coming, but what the overall meaning of it all was a little bit more foggy and harder to parse out until you start thinking about the social commentary of this movie. So that's something this film does do in an interesting way. Let's maybe dive into that.
So this movie, and he talked about that when he was thinking about the, you know, what the sequel was going to look like when he was, I guess, developing the idea. He wanted to dismantle and distill the social commentary around it, the racial injustice. He wanted to get into the backstory in which Candyman was created from, right? Did you find that worked?
I think Jordan Peele had a lot of good meat on the bone here to work with. And I think in the script, it's kind of there. Maybe it's not totally ironed out. There definitely feels like some things got cut and lost a bit. But at the same time, the direction sort of doesn't pull off the film for me. Like, so what I mean is, like, I think there was actually a lot of cool ideas in here. Cabrini Greens has transformed completely. It's not a black neighborhood anymore. It's a pretty much a white neighborhood, a little mixed, but still it's on the up and up, but it's definitely past where it was. It's become a very expensive place to live. Art galleries have moved in, which is always the pioneers of gentrification, which is identified in this film, which I thought was also interesting because as someone who worked in the art industry or the non-for-profit art industry in Canada, it's something we are very well aware of. We're often moving to always escape the gentrification because we're trying to find a new cheap space to work from. And then rents, as we come in, the restaurants come in, the bars come in, and all of a sudden the rents start to creep up.
You know what I mean? Everybody thinks gentrification is such a great thing, but it displaces people.
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, if you go back in time, like my dad owned a restaurant at King in Portland, which is east of, just a little bit east of Bathurst. When he was there, that was the hipster art neighborhood because all those warehouses around there were empty and they were all just art studios.
Oh, no.
That was in the 70s and 80s. And then, like, think about when we're talking about, we were hanging out down there in the 2000s, 2010s. Bathurst, Spadina to Bathurst, completely, you know, completely changed by then. And now we're going as far as Ossington. So you have to know your Toronto geography, know what the fuck we're talking about. But we're going west here is what we're saying. And it just kept getting more and more gentrified. Nowadays, the art galleries are pushed up as far as Bloor and like Lansdowne. And they're still, and they're moving on from there. They're starting to go up to DuPont now. So let's get into the movie, James, because I feel like we're talking around the subjects without talking about the film a bit. What I found interesting here about Jordan Peele's approach is I think what he's trying to do, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but I think he's trying to reverse what Candyman's about a little bit. And it's probably because he watched the first one and identified a major problem with it, which is this. The first character, who is Candyman, is lynched by white men. Then he comes back as an urban legend in the neighborhood of Chicago in Cabrini Green. And what does he do? He terrifies young black people.
Yeah.
Why would he do that if his death and his, you know, Freddy Krueger goes after the parents of the kids who teased him and then who burned him, right?
Please, God.
This guy just kills people in the neighborhood that he existed in. Yet these are not the same people that wronged him. So I think Jordan Peele looked at that and said, that's a weird inconsistency about this character. How do I fix that? How do I turn that around? How do I basically put Candyman and turn him against white people, which makes more sense, right? Why can't we have a black, you know, villain, evil hero, evil anti-hero, whatever you want to call him, like ruthless anti-hero who actually hunts the people who wronged him?
That's where I was kind of left just being like, is that it? Is that just the angle that we're after in this film? And as the film moves on, really that bears out to be true. And you have William Burke's character, who I guess is did you not find it strange that he was like, he's still living in that like fenced off area and he seems to be like, there's absolutely nobody there, but he's still living there. Is that just by circumstance
show anyone, but he does say there's only a few of us left.
Yeah. Like he's got
like, there's like one building left and it's not a high rise anymore either.
And he's kind of like, he owns and works in a laundromat, but he's got like, he comes across as a blue collar worker. And his motivation is to reincarnate Candyman as a savior for the black community against the gentrification of the white pop. Like,
yeah,
is that really what it is? Like,
that's what I was saying. And the only other layer I can add to it is that he feels an immense guilt because he was the person who screamed and then caused, I forget his name, but the Candyman we saw in that opening scene, the laundry.
Sherman.
He's the reason Sherman got killed.
Yeah.
Because he screamed, the cops come running in, and they don't give Sherman a moment. They just start blasting him, right?
Yeah.
And so he does carry some immense guilt in the sense that he feels like a contributor and one of the people that caused and created that Candyman. But yeah, I do think this is the muddy, messy kind of part of the film that doesn't totally make sense. I guess that's what it is. Burke is trying to do as you said, he wanted to scare out the white audience and the white people and sort of reproduce the fear and anxiety of Candyman for these new residents.
Yeah.
But it's probably, I think it.
I think it's more interesting. See, this is
it's also he added that whole thing about Candyman being more than one person, and he just adds that. Like, we don't learn that in any way except that Burke tells us that
the hive, right?
The hive. Candyman is a hive of being containing the spirits of numerous black men who were murdered by whites. And when you get to the final credit scene, you actually start seeing some direct references to real live people that some of this shit happened to.
You know, I feel like this movie is sort of divergent in two ways to kind of look at it, or two main spheres of interest. One is the social narrative. And I think it's fair to say that against the backdrop of, you know, George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, this movie is incredibly charged on those cables. And, you know, as two white men, two white podcasters, I think, you know, I see that and I feel, I don't say I feel the pain from it, but I absolutely get closer to the understanding, at least through some of the filmmaking in that sense. I just found it as a film and as a horror film, maybe that superseded, like, it just was a little bit over. I'm treading on dangerous territory here, right? I just don't want to come across as
that you're not empathetic to the
Black Lives Matter.
I think we know you are empathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
And I think what you're trying to say is just as a film, it doesn't quite elicit the response you would want or that you were thinking you would get.
And I think he struggled with that too in the filmmaking. Like, I can see a filmmaker who really has the subject of Anthony, and I think one of the most interesting things of the film is his transformation. And that's what I kind of wanted to bring it back to. Like, this is a werewolf story, man. This is a Dr. Jekyll or Jekyll and Dr. Hyde story.
There he is. There's your man.
This is a film, actually. The overarching theme in this movie is transformation. I think I'm going to speculate that one of the things that Peele struggled with was how much to shade that with a social narrative.
So have you seen Lovecraft Country?
I have not.
So in that series, Jordan Peele does a much better job at, I found as a white audience member, sort of, I was able to recognize how horrific and how horrible white people were to black people, in the sense that I could understand us as the villain to them in that film, in that series. And it's using race as a horror creature. At times it's literally represented as creature, but other times it's represented as just racism and like violent racism. And you start, and the fear is much more poignant. Like, you really feel it. You're like, oh shit. Like, white people are the bad people in this television series often, because they have to negotiate their existence as black people in these communities a lot of the time. And it shows like how delicate that mode of living had to be sometimes. I found it much more effective than this film was. Now, I still think Candyman has a lot to bite on. Like, I think there's some really interesting stuff. Again, I'm going to go back to the art thing, because Anthony is sort of following the path of Helen, right? Helen from the first film.
Helen.
Yes?
Helen.
293.
Yeah.
Helen's a journalist. But the kind of journalism she does is what you would kind of call now slum tourism. Like, she's going in there, but she has no business being there. She doesn't know anybody in the community. She's almost treating it like anthropology. Like, she's going to go see how the locals live and learn their customs and this kind of shit, right? So Anthony, at the time when he decides to engage in this legend of Candyman, he doesn't know the neighborhood like that. He doesn't know it that well. He doesn't know that he's from there either. So he doesn't have that like hood pass yet, right? Like, he's not, as far as we know of him at this moment, the only reason he's even engaging in this is because it perked up the ears of his white gallerist, the douchebag guy who calls him, "Come on, man, I thought you were going to be America's next black hope. Like, you got to live up to that title." And so as soon as he mentions like, well, Candyman was a local legend in this neighborhood, that kind of perks up the guy's ears, because he's like, okay, gentrification. We're talking about this exact neighborhood, though. Like, I forget what he says, but like, oh yeah, that's been done. But this sounds a little more interesting.
I'm not even sure he's like that convinced that that's a That's a good idea. Like,
he likes it better than the first thing that Anthony shows him, though. That's the point. So Anthony's pivoting, like, on the spot. He's calling he's calling an audible, and he's like, well, what about this thing about Candyman? The guy's like, okay, I can maybe get into that.
Is it that harsh, Rob? Like, if you're trying to show, and they just were like, even it sounds like
this... No, it's a film. They're
I was going to say, it sounded like this artist was given, you know, quite a great opportunity, and then now they're just looking for the next... Like, it seemed like they were very quick to, like, kind of dump on this guy.
Right, but remember, that is the thing that I thought was interesting, too, is that, like, the art world sort of needs these people to position them into this narrative that they're looking to create, right? Anthony's just, like, a pawn in their curatorial scheme, in this sense. And well, that's real. Like, that... I mean, there's definitely curators who are not that, like, terrible people. I just mean, like, there are times where the artist is sort of playing a role within a grander conversation that the curator is trying to make. Sometimes that's totally, like, positive and good and whatever, but this is, like, a guy who's trying to sell a certain story, and he sees Anthony as, like, this piece that he can position within that. There's another connection, too, with Anthony, is that, like, the original Candyman, played by Tony Todd, Daniel Robitaille, he was also a painter, right, from the 19th century. So this art connection is sort of playing itself out again. And you mentioned this is like a werewolf film. It's actually a bit of a Dracula, too, because remember, he falls in love with this woman, and then Helen looks just like her. Remember that, like, there's this moment where we see the painting of the woman that he was in love with, and she looks exactly like Helen.
Exactly.
So yeah. There is, like, this, like, you know, connection to old horror movies and old horror stories. They also cut off his arm, so you see all that. You see that violence.
Yeah.
And he has the bees poured on him. And so the bees become this sort of symbolic way that he is represented later on. The Candyman's usually accompanied by the buzzing, and the bees kind of come out of nowhere. Anyway, I just seeing that there's, like, a few good connections there, like between Anthony and Daniel Robitaille. But as he becomes Candyman, like, that's the weird thing, is that he was doing what Helen was doing. He wasn't from that neighborhood. He was trying to kind of not exploit it, but he was trying to use it as, like, he was trying to, it was funny how quickly he tried to own that story, though. And I was like, he's not from here. So why is he, you know, it's kind of like, can you imagine, like, a New York rapper, like, going to Atlanta and then spending a few weeks there and be like, but now I really get this place. Now I'm going to make all my hip-hop music like this. Like, would he get called out? I don't know. That's kind of what's happening here, right? But then it turns out he is from there. And in fact, he's sort of like a...
Well,
he's a prodigal son. He's supposed to be.
Yeah, he's from the neighborhood. I think he's using his...
He's not that. He was the one sacrificed to the fire. He was supposed to be...
Yeah, or the one they took him, the one that he was saved from the fire, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was a little conflicted too, because I agree he's a good actor, and he's handling the role really well. He's doing everything he can. But there were times where I was just like, I don't get why he's suffering so much. Like, he seems to be, like, undergoing so much anguish about some of these things.
Fuck.
I guess it's because like he's causing... Well, yeah. Well, also, like, he... I guess because he's causing people to die, and he's starting to recognize that he's the reason.
Rob, I just have a question for you. When we talk about Anthony, at what point, how much of your arm and body needs to become, like, a honeycomb before you're going to the doctor? That is one of the things, like, I'm watching this movie and I'm like, it's fucking, I'm checking, it's like an hour and 12. And this guy, I understand the complete transformation is undergoing. Guy eventually goes to the doctor. Rob, half of his torso and arm is turned into, like, he's like pinching his fingers, and it's all like it's all
honey.
It's dead.
It's honey,
like,
baby.
Exactly. Now, honestly, I thought that was, like, silly, but then if I actually were to try to find the rationale behind it, it maybe spoke to the narrative of how health insurance, Obamacare, is hard to find in impoverished communities, and people are unwilling or will take, you know, way too much time before they seek out medical care.
Oh, have, like, you watched Dr. Pimple Popper?
And I have a 55-year-old blackhead that's right in front of my ear.
Like, these people have cysts the size of somebody's head, and it's basically because they don't have health insurance.
That, like, fuck, you're in Ontario, you have a sniffle. You're going to you want to fucking emerge.
Yes, he avoids the problem because he doesn't...
But why is he avoiding the problem?
That's the other thing. I don't know.
I don't understand. Like, to me, it doesn't make any sense. Like, that makes me think, is it not just a physical transformation? Is it a mental transformation?
Oh, of course.
Well?
Yeah. He, like, is. And so he's sort of either not realizing it or not noticing or not caring. But at one point you see his hand at dinner and it's like, dude, there's a hole in your hand.
Yeah.
There's a hole in your hand into your, like I could see inside your hand.
He's picking at it at the dinner table.
I almost wanted them to go like a little grosser too on that. Like show some honey coming out, like the oozy, sticky honey.
I wanted more uncomfortable shockumentary scenes.
You know what they could have done? They could have worked into his art. Like, what if he's sliming the canvas with like this sticky, oozy, you know, gauzy honey stuff coming out of his fingertips or out of his body? I wonder if that got cut out. Like, I feel like there were some scenes missing.
One of the things we've talked about is the difficulty, the extreme difficulty in just writing a good story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple of nuggets dropped, how Anthony like missed dinner with his mom and then eventually is at his wit's end. So he goes to his mom's right at the end and then she reveals, like, she's got that whole kind of story dump right there, which I thought, you know, like that all happens at the end. Just too much, I think, happens in the last 30 minutes of this movie. Mm-hmm. And it just weights it improperly. But you're right with the girlfriend, like, she kind of, like, I don't know, man, if Aaron or Mystica, like, if your hand was turning black and you were completely completely changed, like, my wife, fuck, if I, she's, you know, she just, she's my wife, right? Like, I know this is his girlfriend, but if there's anything that's even out of sorts, she's not just like, oh, well, you know what I mean? Just like she brushes it off, right? Like, oh, you got to get that looked at. Or just brush it off. It's just, to me, there's a couple of things that just are not like realistic with the storytelling, with that transformation piece. So,
yeah, like they have to build her up all the way to the point she's ready to kill because she kills Burke, right? She has to actually kill him with her bare hands.
Yeah, but to survive. And like in an extremely aggressive way, right? Like,
well, and she's a stressful way because I think she assumes he's going to kill her if she doesn't. So, but it's crazy that we're building to that scene. And along the way, like, although I see her being challenged by like these slimy art world people, it's a weird climax for her story. I don't get how we build from through that stuff to that scene.
She definitely felt like to me a very peripheral character, right? And then all of a sudden she's in that final scene and she's there. I didn't feel
and like, she's almost like she's the person who can call Candyman.
I don't know. I really didn't understand the laundryman. And I asked myself if he was necessary to be in this film, William Burke. What role does he really play?
Couldn't
we have found our way? And actually, all he does is strengthen the social narrative.
Well, no, he tells the backstory of Candyman.
Okay,
too.
But you could have, man. What do I always tell you, Rob? The library scene. You could have had. Well, there actually is a library scene in this.
Yeah, there is.
But you could have had another library scene. Now you could have found that, and you know that was like some of the cool visuals they do, right? Like,
well, you're, I don't, right, know, like Anthony's researching Helen's tape, so in a sense he could have learned all that from the tapes.
Exactly, and that could have been like the creepy library scene late at night. It's like very, it's like done before, but it's effective. But now you got this guy that just you meet. Hapstance when he's walking through Cabrini Green and he befriends him, like, right away. It's just set up like, you know, this guy's going to be bad. Like, you know, he's going to be
I didn't know he was going to be bad.
Horror 101.
But I thought he was the kid, right? Like, I immediately knew he was the kid who created Candyman, or at least one of the Candymans from Sherman. And I thought he had more like a guilt that he carried with him. I didn't know it was going to manifest as a revenge thing. Like, I didn't see that coming.
I just think, like, when things seem too good to be true, they are.
Confuse me, yeah. There's another person, and that's Brianna's brother, Troy Cartwright, who actually introduces the legend to Anthony and Brianna. And
yeah, right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, and really out of nowhere, except that he's a real estate agent, and he's trying to tell Brianna that, like, oh, you may have this fanciest condo, but you way overpaid for it, and this neighborhood used to be creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
And then he tells him the story. I wish this was motivated by something. Like, he just seems to know that story. He seems to tell it just to, like, I don't know, for a party trick. Like, other than that, just to say that this neighborhood is haunted. But I mean, if frankly, have you ever met a real estate agent who like told you how shitty the neighborhood was? Like, they always say something like, well,
Well, it's his, they already bought the deal. The deal's already done. He doesn't need to sell anything, right?
I know.
And like that guy's, you know, he's portrayed as an eccentric character. So he, for him to come in and be over the top with a story to kind of get the night started, like, I think that fits to, it fits into his character profile. I'm okay with that.
I just thought it was a little left field. Like, it was just thrown out there. I thought something could have motivated it. Like,
it was like Malignant. He can control things with his mind.
Right. Just like say it and it happened. Yeah. Like, I think Candyman is supposed to be an urban legend now to almost to protect black people against white gentrification. So, and just white violence. So I think there's something cool about that, and that could be a cool sequel. But this setup for it is very muddy.
You just said it. Is this a black superhero film?
Yeah, in a way it is, right? Because like you said, it wasn't scary. This is very much like Malignant, right? Like, it's not scary. It's kind of a superhero film.
Yeah, this is a black fucking superhero movie. Or a black superhero revenge story. I don't want to make white people out to be the...
Well, there's anti-hero superheroes too, like the Punisher and all those other fucking Wolverine. Well, Jamie, let's get our tights on and start thinking about this next segment. I'm gonna make a run for it. Here at Running Scared, we like to play in the cross-section between health and death. I should say horror. exercise and horror. So in that spirit, we have a new segment. This is our second time doing it, where we each choose someone in the film who we think is getting the best workout. Jamie, who do you think got the most exercise making this film?
I'm going to say Anthony's girlfriend.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you why. Is that because... Anthony is perennially missing dates. And so she's got to be running all over town trying to find this guy. And I think of high intensity workout as getting a lot of exercise. And when she finally has that kill at the end of the movie, she is like going crazy and stabbing the absolute fuck out of that guy. Her heart rate would be going. Her heart rate would be spiking up 190. She would be in zone 5. I think I'm going to give it to her, Tiana.
That's a good call, especially that last scene. Yeah, she's doing some serious...
She's getting a workout.
What do you call that? Those high intensity, those HIIT programs? Like a short but fast? Yeah?
The HIIT.
Is that what they call it? HIIT?
I don't fucking
know.
High intensity training. I just run, Rob.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with the obvious choice here, which is Anthony. I think this guy's all over town. He's in the libraries. He's walking around the city. He's painting, staying up late at night. He's going to visit critics. I mean, could you give it to Sherman, the Candyman? Because Sherman does most of the killing, right, before we get the transformation of Anthony.
But is that Sherman, though?
Yeah, it's Sherman, isn't it? Every time we see it, it's
the reflection of Sherman. But is he just?
He's like a husk.
Is that exactly? Is that really? That's the thing. I don't understand why Sherman was the transformation. You didn't see the original Tony Todd, or that's who it's supposed to be, right?
Like, they definitely cast a guy kind of look like Tony Todd.
Yeah, you get Tony Todd. You get the Tony Todd mug right at the end. And that's what everybody wanted. Also, Tony Todd just looks scarier.
Yeah.
Let's just call it what it is. Tony Todd just fucking looks scarier.
Tony Todd's voice is fucking incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to shit on this movie anymore.
He's like a
panther.
He's like a...
Yeah. It's just the original movie was way scarier. And just the investigation pieces were just way creepier. But, okay. So, Anthony's running all over town. That guy's... hopping fences.
And frankly, he's just in good shape. Look at that fucking guy, man. Is that he's the most great handsome shape, man. Motherfucker?
Can't pull off that. Rob, I gotta pull off that hat. You know that hat?
Yeah.
Like the toque above the ears.
Yeah.
It's like the beanie, but with the fold up.
Yeah.
Like, my ears are too big. I can't pull that off, man.
And that guy has got to be top five most handsome men in like the world right now.
And they actually do a really good job of very subtly degrading his physical appearance.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, like, you know, I will say that. You see him at the beginning and then, you know, he still retains his physique, but like very subtly, they just kind of age him in the face a little bit. He just looks a little bit more disheveled.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was really good to see the transition.
Skin's all nasty. Did you find, though, at the end, though, when he becomes Candyman, like, I start thinking he gets a little robotic. Like, he starts becoming, like...
Well, he's in, like, a...
No, but he becomes, like, RoboCop. Like, he's just, like, he walks so slow. His eyes are all glazed over. I mean, I know he just disappears and reappears in places, but, like, I don't know. He just became, like, too stiff.
I thought, like, and I actually, honestly, I didn't like that part of the movie, the fact that he becomes, like, the reincarnation of the legend. I thought that was, I don't know, I didn't think that was cool. It was an urban myth and an urban legend. It doesn't need to be, like, a physical being. It could be just, like, a ghost. And this, like, he goes through it, and that's where my issue with Burke is that he, like, takes this... Did he know any of the backstory of Anthony, or did they just happen to meet and then clearly, like, all the fucking lines lined up and then away you go, like, it ends up being the kid?
Or, that's the thing. They never
it doesn't make any sense.
Did Burke, like, weave this web and set this trap?
Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense. It just... It's way too convenient.
The only thing I can think of is that Anthony introduces himself, and now Burke hears his name, and he thinks, huh, I used to know your mother.
Oh, well, like,
and maybe looks at, because she was there at the time, and Anthony would have been there. Or, sorry, and Burke would have been there. It's the only thing I can think of that where that whole web of, like, how did Burke understand that Anthony is the prodigal son of Candyman. Son,
yeah, it's, okay.
And, like, and is, by the way, is Anthony a new Candyman, or is he also...
Exactly. Or
does he embody those other spirits as well?
Is he part of the hive? Is he the head of the hive? Is that what he is? Because we talked about the other black men that have been lynched over time or killed by white men. And that's his demise the end of the film. So does that mean he's now part of it? But
yeah.
But also, he becomes it, but then you see Tony Todd's face...
Yeah,
right at the end.
Because Helen saved the baby. It was supposed to be kind of sacrificed to Tony Todd's character, Dominic, or whatever his name is. Like, so
she's on the layer at the end. Like, she's part of the myth as well, the legend as well.
Well, when you go back to the old movie, she actually appears as Candyman.
Yeah.
Which they've kind of erased here, right? Completely. She's not in that hive.
So why did that become... Like, that's the thing, is that this movie could have, like, you see the transformation of him, and, you know, he's perpetuating the killings. Well, that's another thing. Is he the one that's perpetuating the killings, or is he just, or not? You know what I mean? At what point is he the one actually doing the killings? Because he's always in the same spot. You know what I mean?
Like, because he kind of introduces him to the idea, and so people go in the mirror, and then they do it, and then they get themselves killed.
Exactly. So it makes me think, like, okay, so is he, at what point is he actually killing? At what point is he not killing?
I'm still trying to tangle that thing about him being, like, a gift that Candyman felt he was owed, and that. And Burke was sort of satisfying that by saying, you know, we took you out of the fire when you were a baby, but you were supposed to be killed for Candyman. So I'm doing this to satisfy him or something. And, like, what does that mean to sacrifice Anthony and then for Anthony to become Candyman? That's the craziest. I'm trying to figure it out, because, like, as a baby, why did Candyman want to kill a baby? I think we better review this thing, because we are going to keep questioning this. So
yeah,
let's put a stamp on it.
Okay, you know what? I'm gonna wrap this up in a bow right now. I was intrigued by the new idea, the sequel that Jordan Peele presents with us, with the direction by Nia DaCosta. To me, it is a transformation story. You know, perhaps not a werewolf story, but I was interested in the story of the transformation. And the connection between the myth and the physical transformation that the man undergoes. I thought that was really interesting. The social narrative behind it, as it shaded it, I thought colored it well. Where this movie lost me was in a lot of the things that we talked about in the podcast. Is it just seems a very convenient. a lot of points of intersection in this movie where Burke and Anthony meet, the motivations for doing the harm to Anthony right at the end, Anthony coming back. Is he Candyman? Is he not? Is he part of it? The killing of Anthony and the circumstances around that, you know, I think we ended up having, and a lot of the podcasts we have, either we kind of laugh or we really dive into things. This one, I think Rob and I ended up questioning a lot of things in the movie and just talking, like talk shopping it out. So I think when we do that, there has to be some merit in the film for invoking conversation, mm-hmm. but also we found it, or at least I did. I found it a little meandering at times, and I wasn't totally sure what he was after. Now, he's a great film director. Maybe he knows more than I, but for me, some things I just didn't find quite clear. That being said, there are some really nice visuals. I think there are some really great performances, and I actually like some of the music in the movie as well. So I'm going to give this movie a safe 3 out of 5 footsteps.
Well, I thought that was high. I thought you were going to, like, I thought, sorry, let me start. I thought, high praise for you, Jamie. The way you were talking about it, I thought you were going to come in lower. I'm going to echo some of the things you were saying. I found these ideas really interesting, and I love digging into them. I think it's really cool to look at the idea of gentrification. And again, what I like about Jordan Peele is that he does help you see a story. I can never see through the eyes of a black person, but I do think he helps you understand it a little bit better and makes you empathize their perspective a little more. Because I would have never, there's certain things about this film I wouldn't have considered unless Jordan Peele had pulled them out and made them part of this film. There are things about the original Candyman I may not have looked at with that perspective if Jordan Peele hadn't put them into this film. So I think there's some interesting stuff there around, like, the gentrification, the sort of, like, reason for Candyman's being, the idea of, like, the slum tourism that both Helen and Anthony take part in, interrogating that, really, like, questioning, like, what is the value of this stuff? What does it do? And then some of the questions that helps you pull off the onion peel, like, yeah, why are we so interested in black culture or examining black bodies, and especially even looking at creating media around the violence towards black bodies? Why is that such a commonplace thing? What do we get out of that, especially as white people? Why are we watching that? And then here we are in a horror movie watching that, you know? And then what happens if you have a black character who actually hunts white people? Like, is that to me is actually pretty interesting too, because I think in the past, nobody would be brave enough to make a film like that. And we're getting to the point where you can now. You totally could now. Yeah. And I think that actually opens the door to a very interesting story. So there was some meat on this bone. I do feel like the filmmaking sometimes didn't live up to it. I don't know if it's the editing or if the script was just too bloated, and so when they were trying to carve things out and make it make sense, it just lost some pieces. Something is discombobulated. As Jamie said, a lot of, like, info dumping in the last third act, in that third act. And when you try to straighten it all out, I do find we're getting very perplexed by, like, the logic of how is it that this character knew this, and why are they doing, like, and his motivation is what? So that to me is a problem when it's so ambiguous. I think they could have done it a lot cleaner and still had a good story that was, like, you know, just even more interesting potentially, because you could have nailed these subjects on the head a little harder and made it a little more straightforward and easier to understand. So I'm going to come in at 3, but only because it's got interesting things to think about, not because I think it's a great film. And Jamie, the follow-up question is to you, is this worse or better than Anaconda?
Oh, shit, man. Shot across the bow. Fuck. Is this... this is what we're saying. Rob, this movie is worse than Anaconda.
I'm going to agree with you. I think as a film, it's worse than Anaconda. But in terms of, like, smart, intelligent, interesting ideas, it has more of those than Anaconda does by far.
Like, and you know, it's funny, we never interrogated the Shuri Shama people like we did.
It's true. Do you like this new idea where I keep asking you this question at the end of every movie?
Good conversation, as always, on a Sunday night, looking at Jordan Peele's and Nina DaCosta's 2021 Candyman. One of the things that I want to mention just before we get out of here is, as always, you can check us out Twitter at Running Scared PD, Instagram at Running Scared Pod. You can send us an email at therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. We have our Patreon. You can find us Running Scared. We have tiers as low as $1 where you can grab some bonus content. You can grab jogcasts that we create, because again, Rob and I don't just podcast and create episodes and shows. We actually create original content, which are horror stories, original audio dramas that actually motivate you to run. We continue to make those. We continue to have those available for you at all audiobook retailers. So we're excited about that. And one thing I want to mention, and I'm actually just going to, I'm going to call it out right now on air, is we talked about doing the new Halloween films. And Rob had, and for those that don't know, which I'm sure you do, Halloween, Halloween Kills, Halloween Ends. Rob, you had the great idea of just, let's just do all three of them in one podcast.
Yeah, is that crazy?
No, it's not. It makes actually a lot of sense. It makes a lot of fucking sense.
So I guess we're not doing a movie review so much as like a franchise review.
We're going to do a franchise review. So we're actually, not even a franchise review, we're going to take a look at a studio reboot franchise review. Because Blumhouse had a 3-movie picture deal where they grabbed the rights to Halloween. And they started in 2018. Then they did Halloween Kills. And then they did Halloween Ends. Halloween Ends just came out on October 14th. I'm actually going out to see it this week. So we are going to, as our next episode, we're going to take a look at the three films as a collection. I think it'll be good. It'll be funny. Who doesn't love Michael Myers? He's one of the quintessential horror figures of our generation.
Yeah, baby.
We did Halloween, the original, which you fucking hated.
Which one?
Not that you hated it, but you just thought it was boring.
I gave it a 4. Fuck. God. No,
did you? No, you gave it like
3.5.
I think, I remember you saying like, this movie, like it's like 45 minutes where he's playing peekaboo and nothing's happening. He's like, he's driving by. He's like, you know, there's a couple of creepy scenes, especially when she's looking out the window and she's down by the sheets and he's in the sheets and whatnot, but he's like peering around corners, but just not a lot happens. The reboot films were awesome. This is Blumhouse. So these were really good. So I'm going to go see the new one. I'll rewatch. So this is good. Anyways, by the time this comes out, these probably won't be out until December. But it will probably be a super long podcast. It'll be really great. We'll do the three films in one. So I'm excited for that, Rob.
Then we'll have to do a Christmas film. Let's not do Krampus again, but we need a Christmas film.
Krampus. Fuck. I think we got to do Black Christmas. We got to do Black Christmas. Well, I don't know. What other Christmas horror Christmas films are there?
Misery? We did Gremlins. We already did that one.
Gremlins was great. That was one of my favorite podcasts.
Anyway, great talking to you again, Jamie. And tune in for another episode next time of Running Scared. The Running Scared podcast is written and produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts, and this episode edited by Jamie Roberts. Check us out on social media. Tune in for another movie review and come running back for a jogcast on Running Scared.
I am the writing on the walls. I am the sweet smell of blood on the street.